I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to continue our discussion of Chasing the Dream, Poverty and Opportunity, a national project designed to explore the effects of poverty on American life. Today, we'll talk about the role of not-for-profits in dealing with poverty and the challenges associated with it. My guests are Ann Mertlow of the United Way of Central Indiana and Bill Taft of Local Initiatives Support Corporation. Please join the conversation. You can call us at 866-476-3881. You can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to continue our conversation entitled Chasing the Dream, Poverty and Opportunity. This is part of a large national discussion about the effects of poverty on American life, and we're focusing in particular on Indianapolis and Indiana, as is appropriate. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Ann Mertlow, who is the president and CEO of United Way of Central Indiana, and Bill Taft, who is the executive director of the Local Initiative Support Corporation of Indianapolis. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, John.
It's good to have you here. So we probably ought to talk a little bit first about the roles that the two of you see, specifically your organizations, have in dealing with the challenges associated with poverty. And I'm going to start with you, but then, Bill, you're going to get a crack at this, too.
Okay. Well, United Way, since 1887 in Denver, has been dealing with the issue of poverty, and really since 1918 here in central Indiana. We know that big challenges like poverty cannot be solved by one organization or one person, not one government. It really takes a collaborative effort because it's an extremely complicated issue. That's why at United Way, we really fight for the health, education, and financial security for every person in our community. And we see those things as being highly interdependent. We believe that we need to invest not just short-term, but long-term in the capabilities that individuals have so that they can get on a path to self-sufficiency. Self-sufficiency being defined as independence to the greatest extent possible for their particular situation. So we focus on things like education because we know it's the best path out of poverty, health because we know that unhealthy kids have trouble learning and adults with chronic health issues have trouble earning a sustainable income, income stability because we know we have far too many families that are operating right on the edge where they don't have savings and what might be a small bump in the road to some of us can be an absolutely tragic financial event for them and their families. And then we know that basic needs has to be a foundation for growth in any of those other three categories. So we focus on the intersection of those and are able to help tens of thousands of people in the process.
Bill.
So Local Initiative Support Corporation, or LISC as we often go by, has been working for 25 years here in Indianapolis to support the work of community-based groups working in primarily the urban neighborhoods of Indianapolis to form goals for the future of their neighborhood and then work together to implement those goals. And one of the truths of Indianapolis, which is commonly true around the country, is that poverty is very concentrated geographically, and there are a fairly small number of neighborhoods that have a high percentage of the poverty in our region concentrated in them, and a lot of the other challenges that go with that. And so we are a very geographically focused organization. I think that's what's most distinctive about us is that we work in those most challenging neighborhoods of Indianapolis, but we also believe those are the neighborhoods that are unique in the region as far as just a lot of the historic assets and opportunities there, and they also offer a lot of opportunity for our city as well.
This is the second part of a continuing conversation. We did a show last week that sort of set the stage and talked about, you know. And the trigger, the news hook, as we call it, in my business for this is the 20th anniversary of welfare reform and sort of the change of that. And I guess the best way I can get in to talking about, you know, the challenges you face is I remember a conversation I had with Senator Dan Coats, not in this current Senate term, but longer in his first time he was in the U.S. Senate from Indiana. And he talked about why reforming welfare at the time was so important because it would get the government out of the way. That, you know, that would allow then the parties that had the institutions that had traditionally taken care of the poor and helped the poor to step up and do so. And he said that meant churches and not-for-profits specifically. That in many ways is what has come to pass. Instead of being a supplement to a governmental collective responsibility for dealing with the poor, the burden of doing so has shifted to not-for-profits such as yourselves. What has that done to your organizations? I'm going to start with Bill first and then go to Ann on that one.
There's an interesting parallel to that happened in the world of urban revitalization a little bit earlier, and that was basically the retreat of urban renewal, which was viewed largely as a failure around the country, and the idea that local solutions had to kind of step in and take that place. And that happened largely in the 80s is when that shift happened. And so LISC grew out of the community development movement, which was started as a grassroots effort by neighborhoods responding as HUD and these large renewal projects did retreat from urban neighborhoods of neighborhoods saying, well, we have challenges that we individually and certainly not the market are going to address. And so we need to come together and do something about that. We reformed to provide resources to those community efforts and connect them together and improve the quality of what happens with that. And so then when welfare reform happened, it was really kind of a next step of that into the world of social services, et cetera. And so ultimately, we've always had to have sort of an entrepreneurial response to these challenges because of those roots in the neighborhoods having to do that with urban renewal going away. And so I think that that sort of idea of the best answer is helping residents and neighborhoods as a whole figure out how to connect themselves to the opportunities of the larger region and where they've been isolated from and build those bridges is a similar philosophy in both of those realms. And so it's that change is one that just kind of went along with sort of a dynamic we were already working with.
Ann.
I think it goes back to the point that I made first thing, which is that we know that poverty is a big enough problem that it really doesn't take one sector or one organization to make it work. We really all have to be working in close collaboration with each other, government included, to make a big difference. We know that these issues are extremely complex, and so the partnerships and close collaboration, including the investment of resources, is extremely important. So Bill and I find ourselves in the same room often talking about ways to stimulate and provide people with not just the short-term resources they need, but the long-term resources they need to improve their lives and also to create these geographic centers of economic stimulus, essentially, that will ultimately create jobs and opportunity for everyone. I think that the world has also changed since the time you talked about, right? In the last 15 years, we have seen unprecedented advancement in technology and adoption of technology at the same time that we've seen a decline in traditional manufacturing. And so we have seen an even bigger displacement of people who don't have those skills to now be competitive in a technology-driven economy. So, you know, we have seen poverty increase in our community, and it has particularly affected not just adults, but also children. So we really need to have a two-generation approach to poverty going forward, and it is a huge challenge. Partnerships are key.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about poverty and opportunity as part of our ongoing conversation entitled Chasing the Dream. It is this is the second of what's going to be four programs we're going to do on this subject. And we're talking about not-for-profits and the safety net, for lack of a better term, that they provide. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. I want to talk specifically, you know, talked about the 15 years. We've also seen something kind of new, too, in that poverty has advanced pretty steadily here in Marion County over the past decade. And that might have been, you know, explainable when the economy tanked 7 or 8 years ago, but the rates have continued. I mean, we've continued at the same time that Indiana's recording record jobs numbers and so many other signs of economic health are good, which sort of shatters the perception that a rising tide is going to lift all boats. There seem to be some that are stuck. What accounts for that, Ann?
Well, I think we have some migration, particularly out of Marion County to the suburb areas, and I think there are many reasons for that, but one of them is education. I also know that we have, of the 75,000 people new to our county, I was just listening to Chief Troy Riggs actually talk about this, mm-hmm. We have gained 100,000 in poverty. And so, you know, we have a growing core in the core of the city, and we have a sort of a wealthy outer ring as well, and we have increasing challenges in the donut around the center. And that's an area that Bill and I are both pretty focused on right now.
Bill?
Yeah, I think that the growth of the regional economy is actually really something we should celebrate as a region, that we are doing well as a whole. But what it takes to participate in that opportunity is now a higher level of education and skills, and also the ability to move past social barriers that stop people from participating in that. And so I think what you see is there's a disconnect between both people and places where there's high concentrations of poverty and that overall success of the region, and building those bridges between those people and the places and those opportunities of the region requires very specific strategies.
We are talking about poverty here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Natalie has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Natalie, welcome to the program.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Hi. I'm familiar with a document that the five bishops of Indianapolis wrote from the Roman Catholic Church. It's called Poverty as a Crossroads. It's designed to raise awareness and call for churches to take a more active role in addressing the need for help for those in poverty. I was just curious if your panelists had any discussion or comments on churches' role in addressing poverty in Indiana.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Natalie. I'll throw that one to Bill first.
I think there's definitely a growing interest among churches in addressing this, and also and kind of at two levels. One is very much at a grassroots level of getting involved in their neighborhood, getting involved with their neighbors, and doing it in a way that is thoughtful and is a development kind of approach, not just maybe having a food pantry, but moving beyond that to thinking about nutrition and being involved with other partners in a larger sort of collective way at the neighborhood level. So I think I've certainly seen that. There's also an increasing activism to say issues of transit and issues of the size of the jail and how it's financed and issues like that are related back to issues of poverty and where churches are more vocal around that too.
And what role do you see for churches?
I would agree with Bill. I think that any organized group in particular has opportunity to get to people, to educate folks on the issues, and to get them involved. So advocacy is a big one. United Way is very involved in advocacy, both for full funding for low-income children in pre-K, but also in things like transit, which is a huge issue for our community.
And it's going to be the subject, actually, of one of our future shows on this subject and the role of public transit in dealing with poverty, and particularly with the working poor. If you are just joining us, we are talking about poverty as part of our ongoing conversation, Chasing the Dream, here on No Limits. My guests are Ann Mertlow, she is the president and CEO of United Way of Central Indiana, and Bill Taft, who is the executive director of Local Initiative Support Corporation of Indianapolis. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about poverty and opportunity. It's part of our ongoing conversation called Chasing the Dream. That's a national conversation about the way that poverty is affecting American life. My guests are Ann Mertlow, who is the president and CEO of the United Way of Central Indiana, and Bill Taft, who is the executive director of Local Initiative Support Corporation of Indianapolis, or LISC, as they call themselves. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Donna has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Donna, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you very much. There's a group of us that have been struggling with the difficulty and the outdated language of poverty that there's new poverty and old poverty, and the things, many things that you, insightful things you've mentioned, interdependent use of resources, self-sufficiency, self-reliance to overcome poverty, independent action for residents, and building bridges and social barriers, and all of these can be addressed very helpfully with using all of our resources in a very smart and focused way. And one of our resources that isn't being used well and applied well is our public library system. And there's a group of us that have been struggling for a year to call attention to this, and we've been pretty resoundingly shunned pretty much by all the media and all the politicians. We've tried to confer with the mayor's office, and we haven't got any place with the Star, with the NPR. And we would like to see libraries focused where communities need these intellectual sanctuaries most desperately. They don't need to be big edifices that are going to put us into debt for decades, but focused where we need them. If you need them closer together in areas where people don't have transportation to get out of their neighborhoods, just like food deserts, we have intellectual deserts, put them closer together. And in other parts of the city where we could have the library not at all, like where my granddaughter lives, she doesn't need a library. She was born with one in her nursery. but other parts of the city, we need them close together. In the area where I live, we have people that are in wheelchairs, they are amputees, they have dragged their oxygen with them, they have little children, their children that are on their own. We have such a need, and we're going to lose our library. So we would like to see some good, honest, close look at that, and we would like to be let into the conversation.
Okay.
Thank you, that's it.
Thanks very much for the call, Donna. And I'll throw that one to you first.
Sure. You know, we have had a number of partnerships with libraries over time. It really depends on the specific programs that we're working on. For example, let me give you an example. Here in Marion County, one of the things that we have done is to support our Financial Stability Initiative, and that is to grow something called the Centers for Working Families. This is something Bill is very familiar with, and he was very involved in funding and bringing it to Indianapolis in the first place. But we are growing that now, and it is a deeper, more intimate approach to family success for residents. We have community centers here in Marion County that we can build on to serve those families. In the outer counties, we actually don't have community centers that can be multi-service centers, and that's an area where perhaps libraries may be able to play a big role. In addition, I'd say, you mentioned having libraries and nurseries. One of our major areas where we are trying to create intellectual centers, obviously, is in the many, many pre-K, quality pre-K centers that are now popping up, and they are going into the highest poverty areas of the city as well. So we're trying to make sure that those young children do grow up and have the benefit of the same situation, I believe you said it was your daughter grew up with.
Well, hi, Donna. I think it's also equally important that libraries be physical places that are at the center of neighborhoods. And one of the things that we are emphasizing right now is this idea of neighborhoods need centers that are kind of a walkable place that is where the social and economic and educational efforts of that community kind of come together into what is essentially the downtown of that neighborhood. And that's really what an urban, high-quality life looks like. And a library is an important part of that. And there are some good examples of where that is happening. We're really pleased to see the library completely renovating and expanding the oldest branch in the city on East Washington Street in Rural as part of our Great Places 2020 work there with Englewood Village. And we'd certainly like to see that all of these sort of neighborhood centers have a bricks and mortar library, because it's more than just a intellectual point of access for people that many people will say that could be done in the cloud. It's a social and cultural center for the neighborhood and an anchor, really, for the life of that community. And it's certainly a place where people who have no other access to the web can go in and have that access for many different important things as time goes on.
Donna made a point and something that struck me where she said, you know, we need a new almost set of terms or language to talk about poverty and the poor. What do people who are living in poverty right now need? It's a simple question, but I suspect not one that's that easy to answer. Bill.
I just heard a speaker this morning talking about health outcomes, and they're all tangled up with poverty as well. And the highest concentrations of chronic health issues are all linked into neighborhoods and people who are living in concentrated poverty. And ultimately, when you look at how to change that, it goes back to social networks, and so a strong sense of community and being connected to other people. Things like access to healthy food. It's things like opportunity of having a job that is consistent, and certainly housing is part of that too. And those things are all bound up together. And ultimately, we think that place is the consistent thing that connects those things together. And where you can, this sort of overwhelming range of things that need to be done to change that dynamic doesn't become as overwhelming when you actually focus that in a particular place. And you can start to create those intertwined opportunities that start to make a difference in individual people's lives.
Anne.
I think that it's different for every person. Mm-hmm. Different folks have different challenges. I think first and foremost, your basic needs have to be met. You have to know where your next meal is coming from. You have to have a roof over your head. And once you're stable in that regard, then you can begin thinking about the longer term. You need access to affordable quality education to have the right start in life. You need access to affordable programs that continue to help you grow so that you can ultimately be able to earn an income, whether you're an adult now or a child now, be able to earn an income in the economy that will exist once you're an adult. The socialization is hugely important. The sense of neighborhood is hugely important because that's traditionally where the supports have come from, both emotional support and actually physical support. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons that we're focused on with Bill on place-based initiatives that bring together all of these services, both short and long term, to help meet the differing needs of individuals who are living in poverty today.
And I know your organization's focusing particularly on housing questions, you know, and made a connection between that sort of the stability of life. Both organizations are. Could you talk a little bit, A, about what you're trying to do and why it is such a priority for you?
Well, on housing, you know, really we talk about the need to get a roof over people's heads. So homelessness obviously is a big discussion point for us. Domestic violence is a basic need. But those programs are always tied with career building and health types of programs as well. So we're investing not just in the person today, but with an end in mind that will help them achieve a higher level of stability in the future. And I think when we talk about a different language, the different language that is emerging is really about economic mobility. You know, what is your opportunity if you're living in poverty today to be able to move yourself out of that situation over the long term? And it takes a complicated web of services that almost needs to be customized for each organization, for each person, excuse me.
Bill.
Well, Indianapolis has one benefit, and that is that we are one of the more affordable cities in the country when you look at wages versus the cost of housing. So, but there are very much pockets in the city where housing is a real big challenge, and sometimes it's around quality. We have a lot of very substandard housing in the same neighborhoods where there's high poverty concentrations. And also it's often around this question of just consistency of income to be able to pay your rent. There's a tremendous amount of mobility. There's a recent book that came out called Evicted, and it's a story that takes place in Milwaukee, but it's very much true in our urban neighborhoods here of just the constant rotation of people in living in poverty from one rental house to another. And really that comes down to an instability in income that drives that. And so I think what Ann said is right. It's connecting people through education, workforce training, mentoring to employment, where they can actually stabilize their income, and then they can stabilize their housing.
Got an email from a listener named Terry that's on point here. And if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Terry says, couldn't the Marion County Land Bank do more to help with the need for housing for the needy? It could create training opportunity for the people rehabilitating the properties, get people off the street, and revitalize neighborhoods. Can't someone convince the local government to work with the not-for-profits and work smart, not hard? Bill.
Well, I'm actually on the board of Renew Indianapolis, which is land banking for Marion County, so I can definitely speak to this one. And it's a huge challenge. We have a lot of vacant housing, pretty much concentrated in the same neighborhoods where poverty is concentrated in our city. And so those two issues are tangled up together. That we do have some really great opportunities, I think, to put those back to use. And one of those is a homesteading program where people with very modest means are petitioning to buy houses for a very low amount of money and then use their own cash and their sweat to put those back into livable condition and put them back into positive use in that community. We also have programs where individuals who are going to renovate and rent houses can do that, can buy that, houses at a very reasonable price if they can show they're going to be a high-quality landlord. And then individuals can buy that have a little more access to capital to renovate those houses as well. And so there's now a pretty good stream of sales happening again. There was kind of a logjam for a while there. We just had the Center for Community Progress, which is a national think tank around these issues of abandoned housing, come in. And what they said basically is we've got the tools here. We just need to collaborate better between different units of government and view these vacant houses as an actual asset for our community and be more serious about using that in a coordinated way. And we definitely have room to grow in that area, but there's definitely progress happening.
I'm going to ask because it sounds like there are parallels. We did a show really on food. We've done several shows on that. And again, the parallel I'm hearing is the theme that emerged out of that is the problem isn't, you know, at least with hunger, isn't that there isn't enough food. It is that it's not finding its way to the people who need it. That somewhere along the way, it just doesn't get there and inappropriate, which is why we have the problem of the food deserts and all of these things which are related to poverty as well. Sounds like to some degree from what Bill is saying, we have a similar problem with housing, that there is adequate housing out there. It's just the people who need it don't have access to it. What can we do about that, Anne?
Mm-hmm. I think it's the same thing. I mean, I think this is a great topic because it does talk about the interdependency of all of these issues, right?
Mm-hmm.
Affordable housing is a big issue. Bill talked about sort of entrepreneurial approaches to dealing with issues like that. And you just highlighted one, right? The ability for someone to come in to have access to homes that are serving no purpose right now and, in fact, are contributing to the degradation of a neighborhood and perhaps even crime in the neighborhood, to turn those back into useful assets for that neighborhood, which then attracts more and more of those services like grocery stores back to the area. I think it's a huge point to say that there is a tipping point, I believe, in the number of services in a particular neighborhood to make the neighborhood sustainable. And those include things like affordable housing, the basics like groceries and like drugstores and things like that, schools, health, access to health care, access to a transit route that will allow you to get to your source of income. Those things need to come together in geography to make it work. And I think housing is a critically important part of that.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about poverty as part of our ongoing conversation called Chasing the Dream, Poverty and Opportunity, which explores the impact of poverty on life in America. We're focusing, obviously, on its effects here in Indiana and Indianapolis. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Robert has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Robert says both of the panelists have talked eloquently on the importance of education as a way to alleviate poverty. What measures do they support in addition to pre-K to improve education for people in poverty? Does that include school choice and charter schools? Anne.
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. I'll give you my personal opinion on this. You know, I do think access to quality education is critically important at all levels. And I think that, you know, pre-K's got to roll up to success in early literacy. It's got to roll up to graduating from high school with a high school diploma that's indicative of either a skill that will support a reasonable standard of employment at a reasonable standard of living or immediate post-secondary work that helps prepare you for the jobs that actually exist in our economy today. I do think school choice is important. I think that when parents weigh in and choose for their children, there is a real buy-in for the family. We had a lot of doubters on pre-K. We had a lot of folks that said, you know, you will never get people really interested, a large number of people interested in these pre-K scholarships. And we got 5,000 applications in Marion County. Sadly, we can only serve 1,500 with the money we have available.
Bill.
There's no doubt that there's a close correlation between quality of schools and quality of life in a neighborhood. You can look at a map and see through an analysis of the number of high quality seats versus the number of school age kids and where they are. Those align best are neighborhoods that are doing well. In the neighborhood where they don't align, where there is an undersupply of high-quality educational seats, those neighborhoods are really struggling. And so we have gotten involved with supporting the development of charter schools and other kinds of educational options because the neighborhood-based organizations wanted us to and felt like they needed other options, or else they just could not compete to attract people who did have a choice where they live to want to stay in their neighborhood as they had children. And so it's just a matter of supplying the demand that a neighborhood has to have in the best way possible. And I don't think anybody has the answer of what that way is, or if there is one way anymore. And so options are important.
We are talking about poverty and opportunity as part of our ongoing conversation, Chasing the Dream. This is the second of four programs we're devoting to this subject. My guests are Ann Mertlow, who is president and CEO of United Way of Central Indiana, and Bill Taft, who is the executive director of LISC. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're continuing our conversation called Chasing the Dream, Poverty and Opportunity, which explores the effects of poverty on American life and Americans. We're focusing, obviously, on Indianapolis and Indiana. My guests are Ann Mertlow, who is the president and CEO of United Way of Central Indiana, and Bill Taft, who is the executive director of the Local Initiative Support Corporation of Indianapolis. Well, one thing I've heard from both of you is that this has to be a collaborative effort, that we have to work across the sectors. That is a polite and diplomatic way to frame it. Another way that it could be framed, and these are going to be my words, not yours, is that not-for-profits can't do it alone. What help do you need? We'll start first. What help do you need from government in meeting this problem, and what help after that? The second part is from the for-profit sector. I'll start with Ann, since you made the mistake of saying,
Well, no, I think you're absolutely right. You know, I mean, I think one agency serving one piece of this puzzle can't do it on their own. We bring agencies together to do that. I think we have other partners like LISC, like the Community Foundation. There are so many other partners in the nonprofit area and the civic organizations that can come together. Not just around direct service and volunteerism, but around advocacy, which is hugely important. I think bringing governments together. You know, I have to really compliment Mayor Joe Hogshead, who reached out to us very early on and said, "I don't want to recreate anything. I want to leverage what we have here. How can we help?" I think one way I would say is that many nonprofits, when they are working with governments, and I'm not talking specific to local government here, are actually expected to do work at less than it costs them to do it, which means that the philanthropic donations that go to that organization are actually subsidizing the work that they're doing for government. That is a big problem. It's a big problem. And so,
could you give me an example of that, Ann?
Well, we actually had a problem with the agencies that serve children in need for some period of time. And for a while, the reimbursements at the state level went down pretty significantly. They're now back up, but it took a long time to get them back up. So we need to keep an eye, I think, on what it actually costs to provide services and make sure that we're adequately reimbursing for those.
Bill.
Well, I think we've realized that the work of nonprofits and government have to be aligned to when it comes to dealing with issues of neighborhoods, particularly neighborhoods with high poverty rates. Government can't change many things in those neighborhoods, but we do need them to prioritize what they do take the lead on. So public safety, infrastructure, other particular programs where where nonprofits really can't affect that as directly. And what that requires then is an alignment of saying, okay, well, where is the most important place to focus limited resources? How do we align those? How do we communicate? How do we build joint strategies? And we absolutely need government to do that. And ultimately, I think government needs these same neighborhoods to be places where people are employed and paying taxes, et cetera. As Anne mentioned earlier in the broadcast, we've lost a lot of wealth out of Marion County. And if our government's going to function, and the poor need government to function effectively more than in a sense than anybody else does, we need to have these be neighborhoods that people will, again, choose to live in, have their businesses in, et cetera. And so we've got to figure out where those most strategic places are and align what government's doing and what nonprofits are doing to ensure we have a viable future as a city.
I'm going to stay with you, Bill. What's the role for for-profits in dealing with this problem?
They are ultimately the solution. There is not enough philanthropic or government money to change poverty. But what we can do is create some pathways to start to reconnect people and places to the opportunities of the for-profit world, whether that's employment for an individual or whether that's a neighborhood where people are again investing again based on a for-profit market-driven motivation. And the abandoned housing challenge, we have, you know, thousands, probably about 6,000 vacant houses in the city. There's no math you can do that shows philanthropic or government dollars solving that. It has to be the market, again, working in our neighborhoods and people connecting to jobs in our neighborhoods.
I would also say that the for-profit community has been stepping up big time in this area recently. You know, I think that nonprofits and for-profit corporations can come together and keep us focused not just on short-term investment, but long-term investment. I think in many ways the failure to deal with short-term with long-term investment over time can create growing problems, and that's why companies like Eli Lilly and Company and PNC Bank and IU Health and Cummins have really stepped up, and many, many more have stepped up to fund things like this pre-K effort.
Gotten an email from a listener named Amy who says, I've heard the idea brought up recently that Indiana schools were originally developed as common schools, but not that now our schools are basically segregated by income. Is this true? And would going back to this common school style be helpful, Anne?
I had not heard that. So I'm not sure I'm in a position to respond to that. I have no knowledge that our schools are segregated. I mean, I think school choice gives you the opportunity to move children around, too. But I don't think I'm answering the question here.
Well, and I think it is. It actually is one of the arguments that school choice advocates advance, that your educational opportunities are defined by your zip code at some level, and that the old segregation patterns of race aren't necessarily there, but poverty and other economic factors do form a new kind of segregation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that goes back to this challenge we have is really it's almost impossible to have schools work well or much of anything work well in a neighborhood where everyone is poor. You have to have diversity of people economically and in many other ways in a neighborhood and certainly within a school for it to be a healthy school. And you look at the schools where kids who come from poverty are having the best educational outcomes. It's when they're in a classroom with kids from middle and upper incomes. And that makes a huge difference. And also you just look at where policing's more effective. You look at where economic opportunities are growing and businesses are growing that can employ people. It's mixed income neighborhoods. And that's really what we need to get back to. What happened in Indianapolis is we lost 57% of our population between 1960 and 2010 in Center Township. And basically everybody who was blue collar and had a good job or middle class vacated most of those neighborhoods and just left behind people living in poverty. And that's just not a recipe for a healthy neighborhood.
We've gotten a comment from a listener named Dan via Twitter. And if you want to find us on Twitter, you can find us at WFYI. Dan says, our state leaders are completely out of touch. You can't be hands off when things are spiraling out of control. I'm going to take the liberty, Dan, if this is okay, of reframing that a little bit as a question. That is, you know, we do have serious problems here with poverty, because, as I say, the sort of time-honored solutions of thinking that more jobs, economic growth, and all of that was going to solve the problem doesn't seem to be working here, that there are people who, to use that rising tide and boats metaphor, the boat's stuck in the muck. It's just not coming up. You know, do you wish at some level that state government would focus as much attention on these issues of poverty and what's happening to the bottom tier of Indiana and Indianapolis's economy as they do to same-sex marriage or to, you know, the question of which restrooms people ought to use? Bill, I'll throw that one to you first.
Well, clearly, we spend a lot of time on things that aren't very practical. Mm-hmm. And I think those are all examples of that.
That was a diplomatic response.
So, and we don't put enough energy into recognizing the payoff of building these ladders back into opportunity from families that have been left out of opportunity now for multiple generations. I think, you know, ever since the shift of our economy away from sort of unskilled manufacturing jobs, there's families that have just essentially been left out of the economy since then. And that's now a couple generations. And that poverty gets more and more entrenched the more generations you go. So breaking that takes resources, and it takes intentional policies behind that. And the payoff on that is what I think a lot of politicians don't understand, is the cost of concentrations of poverty and generational poverty is so high for all of our systems of education, policing, et cetera, that healthcare, certainly that's true as well, that the payoff of addressing that is a great return on investment that I just think we don't do a very good job of looking at things that way.
And why is it so hard to get basically, elected officials at times to focus on questions of poverty?
Well, first of all, let me clarify. We're United Way. We do public policy, not politics. Big difference.
I get that.
But
this is a public policy question.
Well, I think it is. This is a complicated issue. There are many people in government who think every day about these issues. But again, it's not one department that's going to fix mm-hmm. this. I do think that, you know, with the focus on economic development, is critical ultimately to creating the economic machine that will employ everyone. I think that we haven't seen a recovery, an economic recovery, like the one we would have hoped to see. Growth has been, it's taken us a very long time to recover from this, mm-hmm. This last recession. And the jobs that are coming back are ones that many people are just not prepared for yet, right? Ultimately, that economic engine, if you get those jobs, that economic engine will produce the secondary and tertiary businesses that provide opportunity for everybody. But at the same time, you have to be able to bring the skill level of the people that live here up so that they can really be economically mobile and have access to those jobs that happen. I think, and I mentioned this before, mm-hmm. that nonprofits and the corporate community have the opportunity to be long-term focused, where sometimes our political system just doesn't allow politicians to be long-term focused. And so that is an area of focus that we should continue to highlight.
Well, and is that the huge edge that not-for-profits, because as you pointed, you know, most politicians, elected officials, have to think in 2, 4, or 6-year cycles. Mm-hmm. To be fair, and I know, Ann, you come from the corporate community.
But
you probably can testify to this. You have to think often just from quarter to quarter, how you're going to respond to your shareholders. Is that the ultimate strength that the not-for-profits bring to this discussion, is that they can take a longer view and think about, okay, what do we need to do over the next 10 to 15 years? We will still be here. Mm-hmm. A lot of the people who are in office won't, and corporate priorities may have shifted in that time, but ours will not. Bill, I'm going to give you the first crack at that, but I want to hear Ann's thoughts as well.
Yeah, I think that really is true, particularly in Indianapolis, where we have some consistent sources of support for nonprofits like the Lilly Endowment that have just basically created a very stable platform on which this nonprofit work operates. And we do have that ability to have a longer view, certainly in the world I live in, which is neighborhood revitalization, I always say neighborhood years are the opposite of dog years. So like 7 years is a neighborhood is 1 year for a human. And so it just takes a long time for things to happen. And so we have to think long term. And the only way we're able to do that is that kind of financial support that's consistent. And Indianapolis has some real benefit in that area.
Yeah.
I think I agree with everything that Bill said. I would say that businesses have recognized that in order for them to be healthy, their communities in which they operate have to be healthy too. And that means growth. You know, as the CEO of a corporation in town whose revenue was dependent on the health of Marion County, I always thought that our biggest impediment to growth was the challenges that we faced in education. And there's no way to turn that around on a dime. So we had to be focused on those long term. Sure, there are always short term pressures in business, but you can end up out of business in 10 years if you don't focus on some of those long term infrastructure issues that every company focuses on in order to create health going forward.
Gotten a question from a listener on Facebook, and if you want to reach out to us via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. Randy asks, are there resources for ex-felons getting help for housing? It is very difficult to get approved for an apartment. Bill or Ann, either one of you.
Well, I would say the first thing is to try calling 211. 211 is our 911 for human services. It is a United Way agency. It takes about 570,000 calls, inquiries a year, and helps to connect people with particular services. So I don't know the whole of this person's situation, but certainly they could connect you with both basic needs services as well as organizations that you can contact about housing.
Is that a larger, this larger question of crime that is alluded to? Any situation you have with poverty, crime tends to follow it and it tends to make it worse, Bill.
Yeah, what you just said is true. Again, I think this idea and the challenge we have of concentration of poverty is something that does tend to lead to higher crime rates. And we certainly can do a better job of thinking in terms of how we police, and community policing strategies are important. And it's been really encouraging to hear some movement in that direction as far as our police department here. But ultimately, the neighborhoods where we've seen dramatic changes in safety are neighborhoods where many other types of investments are happening.
George, welcome to the program. I'm going to give you about 20 seconds to ask your question because we're getting tight on time.
Okay, I'll try to be as quick as I can. I just wanted to ask the question about the partnership between corporate and the private sector. Most of the corporate entities have moved out of Central Indiana, moved out of Marion County. So what's left? Who else is it in the private sector that the not-for-profits can engage with?
Okay, let me give them a chance to respond real quickly. Thanks very much for the call, George.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ann?
Sure. There's been a fair amount of press about organizations and companies that have maybe been acquired by others that are headquartered outside of Indianapolis. That doesn't mean that these organizations don't still have a big presence here. Companies like Eli Lilly and Company, which is a city within a city, the banks, PNC Bank, as I talked about before, being very involved in pre-K, the utility companies are deeply integrated into the community and wonderful corporate citizens. There are many, many employers in Marion County, and they are pretty philanthropic-minded.
In about 5 seconds apiece, what's one thing an interested citizen could do to help deal with problems of poverty? Bill?
I would say get involved with your own neighborhood if you live in the city and help to make that a healthier place where people who are in poverty can have a better life.
And Ann, I'll have to invite you back to have your word. I apologize.
Course.
We're running out of time. I'd like to thank my guests, Ann Mertlow and Bill Taft. We will be back next Tuesday talking about this subject again. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cherzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.
We'll be right back.